This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Kwetnik Ji. I am the founder of the Little Saigon Historical Society here in Westminster, California.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over. Thank you, Ng, for coming on. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
What it means to be Vietnamese is that we were immigrants once. We were refugee children coming here because of the end of a war. And after that, I think being Vietnamese is we're very flexible people. We're all over the globe as a result of several conflicts in our country, and that we as Vietnamese, we have assimilated, I think, pretty well into the community and the society that adopted us. And that over the years, I think we, because of our flexibility and our adaptability, we have added to the community that we've joined. Nowadays, I think most Americans have heard about the banh mi and the pho and the food and the many people that have gone into mainstream jobs within the rest of the community. And so I think that's what it means to be Vietnamese is being Vietnamese is we were once refugees, but we adapted and we assimilated and we've contributed to society.
So I want to give our audience a little context about who you are and who your family is. If our audience types in Little Saigon and into the Wikipedia page, they'll begin to read the history of the founding of Little Saigon. And it has two men that are highlighted. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but it has Frank Zhao, who built the Asian Garden Mall, and your father, Bac Yan Quat. And this is very important for the conversation because your father has been a pillar of the Little Saigon community from day one and has done a lot of business in Little Saigon, namely probably the first pharmacy in Little Saigon, and has since expanded his footprint in the business world. And you are also somebody who has a practice that that some of my friends have had their wives deliver their kids with you. So you've been around the Little Saigon community from day one. Can you describe what Little Saigon was in the early days when you arrived?
Thank you for that question, Ken. Our family were the original group of 150,000 that was fortunate enough to leave Vietnam by plane. We were the first group that left Vietnam in 1975. There were, I think, about 140 to 150,000 of us. And then when we came here, we were sponsored by my aunt, who had already was living here in the U.S. and was teaching at the, Army Language Schools in Monterey. But for her being here already, it was helpful. It was, she was able to sponsor us. And so when we first arrived to the United States, we went through the camps. In our case, instead of Camp Pendleton, we were at Port Chaffee. And then my father was lucky enough to, through a group of friends of his who were going back to medical school in Nebraska, There were a group of physicians that were in the Camp Pendleton, and they were during that time in the Midwest, there was a shortage of physicians in the small cities. And so they had a program where a city council of this one small town, it's called Loup City in Nebraska, they had sent a delegate of their council people to Camp Pendleton to interview physicians or people who have finished medical school in Vietnam and were practicing and now were here. So there, it was a group of talent that they needed to bring into their small town. So one of the physicians there is Dr. Huang Pham. And Dr. Pham Huang is a good close friend of my dad. And he went over to Nebraska with a group of 30 other doctors to start retraining and with the idea of getting their license back. And then after that, they would serve the small towns in the Midwest. And my dad, when he got here, he wanted to work again as a pharmacist, but he didn't have a way of doing so. Back in Vietnam, he worked for the government in the medical logistic depot. During the Vietnam War, the United States would supply Vietnam with lots of medical supplies, and they needed someone to distribute that. And when he graduated pharmacy school in Vietnam, he was assigned the task of structuring a logistic depot to do that. But when he got to the United States, of course, that was all gone. And so he was volunteering to work at a pharmacy selling candy for a period of 5 or 6 months. And then he got a call from his friend to come to California, to come to Nebraska. And so after 2 years of retraining in pharmacy, and then he was able to regain his license. And so we came down to California in 1978. At that time, Southern California, Orange County, there were a lot of people coming out of Camp Pendleton. And so there was already a very small community of restaurants. There, I think there was one restaurant that was on Bosa. That might be another one. I think the one that was there is either a Guok Hung restaurant or something, but it opened in 1970. It was a small mom and pop thing. And Dr. Huang Pham had already gone to California, and he opened a practice across the street from Westminster Mall today. Westminster Mall and Golden West, if you're familiar with the Westminster area, there was a little plaza across the street, and Dr. Pham opened an office there. And so, but he told my dad, you know, there isn't any other Vietnamese speaking pharmacy in this area. And so if you're interested, you should go look for a place to open. Well, at that time, there was already a pharmacy next door to the Dr. Pham, and so we couldn't open there. And my mother had also finished her pharmacy program, and so they both were looking for jobs. My father got a small loan, and then from Westminster, from Bosa Street in Westminster, he started driving. He didn't want to be too far away from the doctor's office, but he started driving eastward across the Bosa and across a 405 freeway. Then he came down to Beach Boulevard, and he got to Magnolia and Bosa. And there was already a large pharmacy there. Pharmacy, I think, was called Danver Drugs. And then he drove a little further, and there was open space. So toward the right, where his pharmacy is now at 9182 Bosa, was a totally open space. There was no shops there yet. And so seeing that it was open, he went in, he asked, and I still remember looking at some of the contracts that he had signed back then. And it was like he had to put down a down payment. I think it cost him about $30,000 or $40,000 or something to start the pharmacy. But he started opening, he got the lease signed, he opened the pharmacy there. And then about a month later, he's heard some rumblings next door at the space open that was available next door. And it turned out that there was a man who and his family was opening a Vietnamese Asian grocery market next door. And so he thought, well, that was great, because then that become a little community for Vietnamese to come to. And then to the right of him is Mr. Frank Zhao. Mm-hmm. Frank Zhao is what you were saying is the developer of the, you know, the Philippaw. Well, Frank Zhao then, and he become friends because they were next door to each other. And after that, the pharmacy became busy because that was where a lot of the people would come to buy groceries next door for their weekend. And then what we did find was across the street from our office, from his pharmacy, was actually a nursery. It was an open land. I remember I was about 13 or 14 at the time. And I would come out and help them at the pharmacy, would sweep the floor and put and arrange the medication on the shelf. And across the street, there was a nursery. And then there was also some open abandoned land. And there was a big hangar. Now I know there was a hangar. And then because it used to be an airport there, the Midway City Airport. And it was across the street. And to the right where the Phu Lộc Tho is now, used to be a large machine shop, a tooling company. And so that was empty for, that was, it was a pretty much a manufacturing area. So Little Saigon back in those days were sort of a, we call the bedroom community of Orange County. And then after that, every weekend, we start seeing a lot of Vietnamese, our community come to buy food. And what they were also doing is they were buying medicine to send home to their families in Vietnam. A lot of times, this was 1978, 79, 1980s. This is a time when Vietnam was really deep, dark, locked behind the Iron Curtain. No medicine, you know, very little things were coming into the country aside from the Soviet bloc countries. And this is a time when a lot of the families were separated. The people that were here are either here by themselves, they're here without their parents, and they're here without their wives and children. And so they were working very hard to send things back to, once they were able to make contact with the Vietnamese left behind. They were trying to find ways to support them. And one of the things that were badly, sorely needed was medication. And so a lot of the patients were going to their family doctor and asking for medicine, but not for themselves, but for their families back home. Well, you know, as you know, it's illegal. It's not legal at the time to write medication for people that are not here. And so after that, my dad went to Sacramento to ask for special permission to be able to sell medication without a prescription, but with the caveat is that it has to be sent directly outside the country, and not they're not allowed to be taken outside of the pharmacy to for consumption, but to be sent outside. So he was able to get a special dispensary from the pharmacy board to be allowed to sell those kind of medication. So people were buying antibiotics mostly for their loved ones back home. Some of their loved ones were placed in re-education camp. And so there were to get medication to them. Sometimes a lot of the families have to make long treks into these camps, and they would bring these medicine to them. But because of that program, then the community no longer was cheating the system. Instead of going to their doctor and telling them about symptoms that they don't have, and so as to get medication for people in Vietnam, now they can buy medication legally, but it has to be shipped out. So the pharmacy became like a little place where people come there, they would buy fabric because that was needed. And they would buy things to put in the box. So that then those boxes become, you know, the things that they were sold with the when the medication is the box of medication will go to the family, but the fabric and the electronics that they buy to put in there would be used to bribe people so that they can get that medication to their family. And so that was it was the lifeline for the Vietnamese back then. And that's something that my dad was always very proud of that he was able to do, because he said that many years later after that, he had a man who came to his pharmacy and told him and brought a vial of medication with his name and the pharmacy label on it. And it says, you know, he told my dad, if I ever were, it was able to escape, to leave Vietnam, escape the education camp and get be well, if I get to come to America, I would have to come and see this person, because it was the medicine, he said, helped save his life. Wow. And so my dad, when he said it, not realizing, my dad was very emotional about it. He said, well, you know, at least I felt like I've done something that was helpful. And so from this simple task of making it convenient and making it legal for our community to send medication to Vietnam, there's one person that was affected by it enough. They came to the United States and came to thank my dad. And so years later, you know, he told me that, and he said he was very gratified by that. But a lot of times the things that he did was out of necessity. It was the changing times. After 1992, when the lifting of the embargo, then there was no further need for that. Vietnam was able to import medication from different parts of the world. And so that task was done. But Little Saigon back then, I think, had Orange County would maybe, I think the numbers were like, had 20 or 30,000 Vietnamese in those days. Now the numbers are above 400,000 in Orange County. But that was the nature of our community at the very beginning of Little Saigon. And of course, the relationship between my father with Frank Zhao has been, because they were next door neighbors to each other. And Frank was the business minded real estate developer. And so my father went along with a lot of the investments. One of the things that they did first was opening the first project together was on Bolsa and Ward, which is Trung Tâm Nguyễn Huệ, they call that. It's still there. They sold it many years ago, but that was the very first plaza that they worked on together. And then after that, the Phu Lộc Thọ, the Asian Garden Mall, which the mall next door to my office now, and then the one across the street. So that I have photos of the development, the period of groundbreaking and development of when they bought the nursery, they developed the old airport area to build the two malls that sit directly out across the street from the Asian Garden Mall, which is also named with the same name, Phu Lộc Thọ, because it doesn't have the three statues in the back, so many people may not know that it's also named Phu Lộc Thọ across the street as well.
You know, you got a front row seat to the development from an early age. Did you ever think that at one point that you would be the one that collects the history and documents it and put it up for the public to kind of view it?
I've always been interested in history. And so I've always interested in being able to tell stories. I'm not the greatest storyteller because my wife and family tells me that I tend to be too wordy when I describe stories, tell stories. And you probably would see that in our conversation today. But I always like the stories. I always like where people come from. I always like to the origin of things. And so having the benefit of being right there, like you said, in the front line, I felt that it was sort of my responsibility to be able to keep that story and to retell it in photos and in videos. I have been collecting videos, especially VHS videos. There were several events throughout the last nearly 40 something years in our community. One of the well remembered event is the 1989 high tech protest at Dengzhong protest, and it just happens that it happened in my father's plaza. The plaza that's on Terre Bouchard is a project that he went on his own as a real estate developer without Frank Zhao. Mr. Frank Zhao was busy with another project, so he went on that on his own. And it was his baby, it was his development. And it just happens that he was the landlord during that time when the Dengzhong incident occurred. His tenants were quite upset because they weren't making money during the 53 days of protest, and there was possibly danger to the plaza because there was like 15,000-20,000 people out there at any one time. Wow. And so you can imagine the worry about property damage and so forth and interruption to the business. But at the same time, we had to protect Mr. Dengzhong's ACLU, his rights to do that. And so he was kind of stuck in between that. And, many people may not know that even at the end of the event, he was still involved in a lawsuit. Dengzhong and his ACLU lawyers were still locked in a lawsuit against my dad for not protecting his civil rights. In the end, fortunately it prevailed, but 5 years after that, then my dad one day came home and said, "Oh, it's finally over now." I said, "What's over?" I said, "Well, we were in a lawsuit with Dengzhong, and now it's over." And in the end, the ASLU lawyer came up to my dad and says, "I'm sorry, Dan, but this is what we had to do, and so we had to do our duty to protect his rights." And my dad said, "No, it's okay. He's not upset about that. He knows that it's something that that the attorneys have to do." But but since I had all these materials and newspaper clippings, and my dad's also somebody who likes to archive things as well, so he kept a lot of the things from the last 40 years that was in the community. And so I thought it was my responsibility. I felt responsible for collecting them and archiving them too. It's because it's something that my dad, I think out of respect for him, the things that he likes to collect, likes to keep, then I want to be able to take that and do something with it for him. So I think my involvement with the project of Little Saigon is mostly it's something that I'm doing for my father.
Now, when did you have this idea to create the historical society of Little Saigon?
It came out of, I was involved with another project before this, and it was a project a group of friends of mine wanted to do for the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. And they were there's a group of about five or six of us that my parents are not military, my family's not from the military background, but the other gentleman in this group is. And so they said that to remember our parents and maybe part of their legacy. It's not so much about political, but it's more about honoring a part of our parents' past. And so we decided that we wanted to put together a museum, a place to collect. And then we met with a a Vietnam War memorial memorabilia collector. And we thought, wow, you know, there was a lot of things that we didn't know about the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. We didn't realize that there's a whole world of collectors out there that are very interested in everything ARVN, A-R-V-N. And so we thought it was neat to be able to provide a space, to provide a place for people to come and look, for the older generation to be able to take their grandkids to go and say, you know, yeah, you know, I was in this division, or I was in the Air Force, I was in the Navy or the Army. And so that they're, you know, that generation who are now in their 60s and 70s would be able to take their kids and their grandkids to come and say, yeah, you know, we're here in America is because of the end of the war. And I fought on the side that did not win. And so we're here to, but this was part of my past. I want you to, you know, see it. I want to see where pictures of where I had gone to school in the military academy. This is the type of uniforms that I wore. And so it's something for their children to be proud of their parents or their grandparents for their part in the Civil War conflict.
Now, and so let me ask you something about this, because I feel like my generation, which is a little bit younger than your generation, I was like the first wave to be born in the United States in 1975. My father served on the ARVN side, ARVN. My dad's two older brothers all went through re-education. My grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was killed by the Viet Minh at the time in 1945. So we have this long legacy in my family of people serving in the South Vietnamese government on the military side, or the sort of the police side. They were part of the Phoenix program, got sent to Quantico for training with the CIA. So my history leans heavy on that side. However, I am born here. I don't have the same emotional ties to my father's history, nor did my father really ever push that. He understood this is a very intellectual game of really just survival, you know, on that level. I feel the disconnection from the pain and the suffering and the loss that the previous generation went through. I feel it. I understand it. I grew up with it. However, at this point in my life, being in my late 40s, I kind of want to see a different cultural shift of bonding back with the motherland. So I've taken, you know, 2-3 trips a year for the last 20 years. My brother lives there for 20 years now. And I want to get your perspective on that. You know, how do we do this my generation and younger, in a respectful way where we can move forward and we can advance our cause as the Vietnamese throughout the world as a one unit? Is that sort of too delusional to kind of want that?
I think it's been transformational for me, having gotten deeply involved with the task of storytelling and through memorabilia and through stories. I think my answer, I'll get to your question soon. I think is that yes, it is possible to be able to reach the point where we can have sort of where Vietnam is no longer a war, you know. I think it takes a tincture of time. Certainly the years that has gone past us have started to transform us. Because when I was involved with the Museum of the Republic, I realized that there were people who would come to the museum as part of being involvement. I would sit there on the weekends and and as a docent and to receive visitors. And I would see people come with different impression, with different expectations. I was surprised to see who would come and contributed their story or contributed their their artifacts. There were times when people would send in their old helmets, their old letters, their old flight bags to give to the museum.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
So that they can share part of the story. There's some that had kept, there's a story of an Air Force helicopter pilot who was living out of state and has heard about our museum. And he has sent me a whole duffel bag of his stuff, of his things. And some of those things were his old medals, a flight log of 1975, his last flight out of Vietnam, how he landed on the Midway, and details like that that are great for a collector and great for the museum and great for us to tell the story of the last days of Saigon, right? And then I realized in the back of his commendation from Vietnam, because a lot of the army people who leave, they would take these things with them to prove that they were from the Republic, and so that it's just like part of their identification and so forth. But in the back of it, then I read like things that was happening in his life. Like in the front would be a commendation that was from before 1975. Then after that, in the back, then I would see like little notes that he would write about people's phone numbers, about his children and so forth. And then I was thinking, these are his personal affects. Why is he giving it to the museum? And then I realized, people, I think they are done with that. In a way, it's a symbolic part of like letting go of his own past,
yeah,
being able to move forward. I see grandparents bring in their kids and point out something in the glass case that says, yeah, that's the kind of uniform I used to wear. And then the kids, they were interested, but I think they were interested in the fact that their grandfather used to do that. But then when it got to the point where, then why are we here? How did the war end and so forth? And the conversation kind of like moved on to something else. And so I realized that the war was between the North and the South lasted 20 years, 1954, 1953, and it ended in 1975. This is 20 years. And so we've been in the United States now for more than 20 years. And I look back and see, a decade has passed. And two decades has passed, and so a lot of things have changed, and this is a very small part of our history. And so that's what brought me to the next story, and that's what made me interested in doing this history of Little Saigon, because it's actually the history that goes beyond the war. It was how we develop, how we change in since the war, since 75, you know, 75 to 95, that's 20 years there, and 95 and coming up soon. And so we're going to get up to about 40 years since, you know, and 50 years coming up pretty soon. And so I realized that that's why I wanted to tell the story of the development of Little Saigon. It's not just the business community, but it's our lives, it's our transformation after the end of the war and how we should go from here. And I think it is an issue of the it really is one of the medication that we sometimes give to our patients is we tell them just give a tincture of time. Sometimes time is medicine in itself, is because sometimes you can't overtreat it, you can't push it to fix it, but you just let time do its thing. And oftentimes that's all it's needed. So going back to your question earlier is can we be able to have a change in the narrative of our community? And I think it is possible.
So we are at a different junction today, which is close to 50 years later. And there is a very important document that you sent to me. I had heard about it before, but you really crystallized in my brain because I opened up the link and read it. And it is called the Ngikwit 36, right? And what does Ngikwit mean?
My understanding is that it's kind of like a directive.
Okay. So it's the Directive 36. Is anybody can look it up online. It's in Vietnamese, and I got to read the whole thing. And what it really says is the Vietnamese government is setting out to bring every Vietnamese around the world closer to each other, closer to the homeland, and we will do everything possible to make things easier for returning Vietnamese, whether it's buying land, property, adopting children. This document says a lot of things. And I have a lot of questions about this document as it relates to the government and its sincerity. What are your sentiments and what are your thoughts on the document itself? If you would feel the government of Vietnam was truly meaning or intentional about what they were saying, because it feels really heartfelt when you read it. You know, they just want to bring all the Vietnamese diaspora together to feel a connection with the homeland. They're going to do everything in their power to make and facilitate an ease of coming back to spend more time, to invest, to adopt children, whatever it is that we are worrying about here in the diaspora. They're addressing it by saying, you know, we want to have an open arms policy to the Vietnamese returning to Vietnam. It seems very honest and it seems very appealing, but at the same time, is this just more propaganda to bring more economic value back to, you know, a developing country? And then how is the Little Saigon community sort of reacting to this directive?
I think when I was first introduced to it, it was introduced to me given to me in a negative light. But if I were to eliminate all of the way that it was introduced to me and to read, and I have read it, and I felt like it was very logical, very loving, yeah, very embracing of, you know, our country. Vietnam has, you know, we were colonized. And so it is during a time when, you know, with the new way of thinking about the colonial years, certainly it gives it a different perspective now. But looking at the Ngikwit by myself, the Directive 36 by itself, it's a directive where it's saying that, you know, your family, your mother, In this case, your motherland or your fatherland says, you know, gather the flock, bring the people home. You know, we would be able to have final reconciliation and be able to the people that were benefiting from the unplanned or exodus. Because back in the years in 1978, 79, you know, I remember my parents would say, you know, we really miss our home. We really miss our country. We're here in, you know, the foreign land. And it's not our home. We really miss it. But, you know, as Vietnamese families go, we always try to see the bright light, the in everything. And so we say, well, just think of it as an opportunity for all of these people to be able to to go abroad for school. Because right. back That's in those days, did. Before yeah. 1975, only the wealthy get to go abroad.
Right.
And here you have like hundreds and thousands of people all of a sudden get sent abroad for school. And so think of it that way. And then I remember thinking that I said, yeah, that's true. And I think that thinking like that made them feel better about their lonely existence here in a foreign land. And so, but with that, then he said, okay, well, that makes sense that if you get a chance to DU Hub, you get a chance to learn, get education from the West, education for technology and science, and then what do people in the past used to do is they help their country. And so it's a logical next step when you read the Directive 36 is this a time for you to come back and help and to build the country.
You know that the directive, when you read it in Vietnamese, this is how I felt like it was an 80-year-old father. Mm-hmm. Hasn't seen his children for 50 years. And the voice of the letter is very sincere. The directive sounds very sincere. And it's like your father hasn't seen you in 50 years. And he's saying, please come back. We are doing everything in our control to make life easier. And we're not perfect. And we don't have it figured out yet. But the subtext reads like, very honest. And, you know, I think when a government puts out a directive like that, and it's so heartfelt, we can kind of surmise that, yeah, you guys probably won't get the execution right. You guys probably won't get the flow of the improvements down within our expectations as people from the West. But the heart and the soul of the message is very loud and clear. And this is what I struggle with daily when I think about the reintegration as an American-born kid with Vietnamese roots to my motherland. And it tears me up inside. And that's why we're here together today to discuss this emotional ripping apart of, you know, a people of my sort of viewpoint of we want to be one. We want to step out of an airport and feel proud to be part of the tapestry of the Vietnamese throughout the world, throughout the history of Vietnam's 1,000 years. We want to be included in the title or the branding of being a Vietnamese person, whether they're in Vietnam or the US or Germany. It doesn't matter. I want that. I work hard to have that unity, and I want to kind of Bakwa is a heavy word, but it's sort of like in the spirit of a prodigal son's son, which is my father's the prodigal son, returning back to the roots. I want to see this happen so badly.
I think there are, unfortunately, there's different layers. There's reasons why there are some people that still want to hang on to the not wanting to forgive or not wanting to let go, like you or buông ra, And you know, out of respect for the people that had suffered mortally, like they would have family members who had maybe family members who had died in the war or in the aftermath during the incarceration. And I think certainly when you mentioned that it's like an 80-year-old father calling the children to back home, of course, you know, there'll be some kids that were not, did not feel like they were treated well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are some kids that were rebels, or some kids that were, they felt they were slighted by the mistakes of their 80-year-old father, because, you know, we're not all perfect. And so I believe that there are, and especially it's concentrated in our Vietnamese diaspora, because they were the one that had to leave under circumstances that were against their control or against their, you know, it's because if by staying, they were concerned that there'd be in dire straits. And so, and some suffered. And so, because it is a concentrated community of like-mindedness, I think that's why it takes longer. And of course, when there had been missteps by the father or missteps by the parent or country, of maybe missteps in treating their portion of their population the wrong way, I think. In respect of at the things that leading up to the end of the Vietnam War, there's two sides to the conflict. And I think afterwards, there were definitely opportunities to have true reconciliation. You know, had the winning side came in and used the talent of the people in the South to rebuild the country instead of ostracizing them and taking them away from their, I think those are missteps that have further, instead of reconciliation and unification, it became, some people felt that they were punished for really not doing anything bad, but just be having a different opinion. Opinion on how the country should be governed, or the system the country should be governed, or they just may have followed, different ideas. You know, sometimes you commit to following something, and even if you find that it's no longer correct, you still follow that. And, you know, there's different reasons why people follow a certain ideology. But as a result, I think it these missteps needs to be settled. Because I know, I think in the United States, we're still talking about reparations for missteps of the United States toward the African-American community. There were talked about reparations for the Japanese-American community for government missteps. Yeah. And so these actions from a government or father, that wants the children back, I think there are some things that need to be addressed. And I know that, of course, with time, some people will forget, some people will no longer hold on grudges or hold memories, or their parents have passed on. The people that are angry, they passed on. And so that's why the tincture of time is one way. But the other way is to recognize, saying that, yes, you know, these things, we were wrong, and we would like you to come back. And we will do want these things to help reconcile those things, those issues. One, I know that Vietnamese is sort of kind of like a confusion community too. In our culture, we respect our elders, we respect our people who relate to us have passed on. So we tha phuong, you know, we We honor their gravesite. We honor their memory through, yearly memorials and things like that. And so one of the missteps, I think, is the not taking care of the military cemeteries. I think that's one of the things that I believe there's already steps toward changing that. But I think being able to do some things to repair that rift is to take care of the dead, sort of.
That was a big deal. That was a big deal in the 90s with John McCain and Bill Clinton trying to come back and figure out how to reestablish relations. The honoring of the dead and the fallen was not really tended to correctly. But I think overall, it's like having an analogy of an 80-year-old father is kind of complicated because there's many voices to that father. It's not just one voice. It's not just one father kind of with his heart talking to his children to come back. Within the mind of the father or the mind of the government, there are many different dissenting voices on how things should be handled. And I think the nuance of that is sort of lost in our community sometimes here in the diaspora, because if we don't kind of understand that there are so many factions in a government, then we just kind of roll our eyes and just discount, a letter or a directive that's written like that. Just as in the Little Saigon community in America, Little Saigons throughout the country, there are so many different dissenting voices as well.
Yes. I think you cannot fault an entire entity for individuals, right? Individuals' right. decisions. And and going back to the idea that earning a skill set, when you get a chance to go abroad and learn new skill set, then be bringing that skill set back home to improve your community, your old community, your ancestral land, your ancestral community. That's of course, not every child who goes abroad to school will always come back to do that. But being able to come back and help the community, I think that's a very noble ideal. And I think the Directive 36 wants to encourage that, is to say that, look, we value your skill, we value your contribution, we value your work, and if you want to come and you have a connection still to your homeland, you want you come and help to improve it and to be a part of the pride of our people, then we welcome you to do so. I think there's an increasing percentage of people, of younger generation people, who will do that. And I don't think it's healthy to keep instilling the conflict is because I think it has to be where you come and you want to embrace and do charity. There's people that come back and there's increasing groups of people that are coming back to do charity, to help, because there are certain still, although the country is improved economically and financially and the livelihood of most people is probably better than 20 years ago, but there's still work to be done. And certainly, there's a lot of things that the expat community can do to come and help. But also by coming back, it's it forms your roots. I heard a really good quote once. It's called, the best thing that you can do for your children or the next generation is to give them roots and wings. And simple as it is, it seems makes a lot of sense, is you give them a sense of where they come from. And then you give them a skill set to fly, to be able to do things, to get better than yourself. Người Việt mình thì có cái câu, Vietnamese, we have, you know, nhà con hơn cha thì nhà có phước, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, and những cái câu ca dao like uống nước nhớ nguồn, you know, when you drink water, you remember where it comes from. Ăn trái nhớ kẻ trồng cây, you know, things like that. That's things that are part of our Vietnamese psyche. And I think the political conflict is very superficial. It's in looking back at our history, our conflict with each other is, I think it's external. I mean, we just wanted Vietnam for ourselves, you know, Vietnam governed by Vietnamese. And at that time, of course, there's different people who have ideas on how it should be, you know, what kind of political structure it should be. Should it continue with a monarchy? Should it continue with socialism, communism, or the Western style democracy? But, you know, at that time, if we start looking back at the history, you know, we had the Cold War going on. All of a sudden, we're kind of pulled into that Cold War. We had to split up our families. You know, 1954, a lot of people from the North had to move to the South. And of course, there's always going to be bad actors and bad players, bad politicians within our government. But, you know, as a whole, you know, it's the people, you know, it's the family that lives in the villages that you want to be able to provide for that family so their kids can better themselves and get out from poverty. And you want to do something to be able to help those people. So you don't think about that when you're doing something, you're going to enrich the wealthy. No, the wealthy is already wealthy in any society. You're not going to enrich them anymore. But what you want to do is you want to be able to give some help to the really poor people. And those people, little things really help them. So
have you been to Vietnam?
The last time I got to go was 1995. Oh, it's been a long time.
Why have you not gone back more?
I've been really busy at my work. As a solo OBGYN, I can't really, you know, if I leave more than 12, you go to Vietnam. I like to stay longer, at least 2 weeks. But I've never taken more longer vacation more than 10 days. Mm. And with my children being small, we thought it was hard for them to travel for that far. And they will only be able to travel in the summer. And so it was too hot. But we do have in our plan that our children is old enough to be able to appreciate their roots. And we will take them back. To see it, yeah.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing your thoughts on that when you come back one day. You know, today we got into a lot of topics that really helped me, and I hope it helped the audience sort of see the progress that's being made both in Vietnam and in Little Saigon. And I encourage any of the audience who visit Little Saigon to stop by the museums or any sort of landmark that we just described. And the museum's open, I assume, right?
Yes. I'm not a part of that project anymore, but I know that they are still they're still open on the weekends for limited hours to visit. Another group of friends of mine, we did a project called Pop-Up Museums. And so the subject is not military, but it's like things that are from before 1975, like interest in literature before 75, interested in street names of Saigon. You know, our Saigon has changed names so many times. And so there's actually books about the names of with French names on it. Then after the Republic, then has Republic names after it. Then now names have changed to post 75 names, and so it's you know things like that that interests in some people. And so we do pop ups. We only had two pop ups, but the pandemic kind of slowed us down. So you know, Little Saigon Historical Society right now, the work is mostly is to archive and to digitalize documents and videotapes and to just keeping them for later on. If we have a physical space, we may be able to provide something like that for the community to share.
Well, thank you so much, NG, for all of the work that you do. And I know the cities, Westminster and all of these cities recognize the work that you do, the volunteering and all the time that you put in to really build the community. You're one of the pillars of the Little Saigon community here in Southern California. Thank you for all of that service and thank you for coming on today.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts.
Of course.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.